Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Experts, I'm here with Troy and Bethany. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Thanks so much for making some time for us and joining us on the Ethics Experts. I'd love to just kind of jump in and get started. We've had some great conversations, and you know, this is again part of our vendor pain point series with respect to Hotline. And I think you guys have had a really interesting kind of path. And before we dive into that, I'd love you guys to just tell us a little bit about yourselves, how you got into this game. Bethany is the head of legal, and Troy is the head of HR. And so maybe you guys just tell us a little bit about your organization, you know, high level size of it, and a little bit about your backgrounds and how you got into this game.
Troy, why don't you go ahead?
All right. So I got out of HR when I got out of the military. I always wanted to do something working with people and definitely moved up in roles. I've been with our company, Human Good, for 7 years. We started as American Baptist Home for the West. We keep affiliating and merging and growing. We're in 7 states. We have 5,000 team members as of today.
Wow. Bethany? How did you get involved with this company? And tell us a little bit about your background and why you landing where you're at really resonates with your kind of inner why.
Okay. So Human Good serves primarily folks over 55, seniors. We provide continuing care and affordable housing, mostly, and we're sort of, our greater mission is to help people live lives filled with purpose. And that mission itself definitely resonates with my greater why. But in terms of my role here, I've been interested in advocating for the elderly since before I went to law school. I started at a, out of college, I started at a nonprofit called Legal Assistance for Seniors. I went to law school, continued to kind of work with nonprofits. I worked in private practice for about 8 years, but also mostly had nonprofit clients in the healthcare, education, and senior living spaces. And so, and 5 years ago, I left private practice to work part-time for Human Good. Then it was then known as American Baptist Homes of the West. And when my predecessor decided to retire, stepped into this role.
Very good. So 8 years in private practice and you kept your soul. That's huge. What do you think it was? Was it just the way that you're wired, or was it just the way the types of clients that you were doing work for that allowed you to preserve everything through that, you know, through your path through law school into where you're at now?
Well, I think that, you know, it's possible for anyone to keep their soul in private practice as well as just the world at large. Not a perfect place. So you just have to sort of follow your heart and your morals, and also, you know, look for good examples. And my former boss in private practice and many people I worked with in private practice were really strong ethical people. And I followed Louise Rankin, my former boss, to Human Good. And I've always tried to live by her example. So I think seeking out mentors and role models that that live the way you want to live is a key.
That's a big point. And when we were talking before the podcast, you know, I want to get into you guys' culture and things like that, but how quickly when you came over to Human Good, did you feel it resonate with you?
When I came over, it was challenging at times because the nonprofit world is so caring, and doing the employee relations side, where we're a little bit more by the book, or we have to be legally at times, it was really tough. But then after, when you get acclimated to that culture where you're not just caring about the residents, like our team members care about each other. We have a thing called the Team Member Crisis Funds that I started, and the team members all donate in money to help out other team members in crisis just here in our own community. Like, we have like our own little Red Cross going on.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing place. So once you're here, nobody leaves. You get indoctrinated into that culture of everybody cares for everybody. People either share personal information you would never share in another company. It becomes like a family.
Bethany.
Yeah. I would echo that for sure. And I think for me, I think it was on day two or so after having joined Human Good, I was in the break room and I think three people independently said to me, "You're going to love working here." And I just, you know, I don't think people say that if they don't mean that you're going to feel at home and that you're going to respect the people around you and feel like it's a good place.
Yeah, people don't like say that on their own. So that there's kind of two pieces of evidence in there, right? They actually mean it and they actually want you to feel that as well. They want you to actually fold into the family as well. So that's a family of open arms. And what a powerful way to like enter into a new organization. That kind of speaks to this larger thing that we've been talking about, how important culture is to your organization and how you guys have done a great job of carrying that forward. And so, you know, this is our vendor pain point series. So I'd love to, you know, talk about your hotline experience and maybe just bring everyone, you know, maybe before we get into those details, just talk a little bit about your individual focus areas, because you guys both touch this aspect of your organization. So if you could talk about a little bit about your individual roles in the company, and then we can dive into kind of what your experience was like and how that led you to taking it in-house.
You want to go first?
Well, Troy, since, yeah, I mean, you were kind of around and involved with the compliance hotline before I got involved. So maybe if you want to talk about the background.
All right. So we used to have a vendor here that did the compliance line, and we have elected to take it in-house. Part of it stems from what you mentioned, and that was the culture. We have our five core values, and one of our core values is courage. And as I mentioned before, it's not just the values on the wall. Every team member needs it on their performance review. It's during their interview packet. So everyone here is really indoctrinated into the culture, and knowing as a brand new wait staff, 18 years old, working in our community, that the company values courage. We actually don't have, consider some people that are still nervous, but we don't have fear. We actually get a lot of what we call feedback. We actually get a lot of compliance calls. And they're not serious. I think our company is probably the most ethical I've ever worked at, and I've worked at several. But we do get the calls. So people are comfortable calling. I know that once they've called, they feel really good about it. I have people that just call me directly once they know that I'm responsible to the employment side. So I handle the employment side and Bethany handles the resident side. And so the team members feel really comfortable and they call me or they call Bethany directly. And that sort of explains why we're good at bringing in internal. I wouldn't recommend everybody bring in internal. If you have external, that's great because people might feel more comfortable talking to somebody outside the company. But in our company, people call myself, even as big as we are at 5,000, people call Bethany. So I think we've established to where it's okay to call the corporate compliance line so people don't have that fear. And I think that's why it works. And we sort of divide it up between the resident or patient side and the employment side between the two of us.
So you kind of rely on the trust that your organization has built from a cultural perspective or from everybody kind of being a family perspective to kind of overcome any like latent fears folks may have that would make them want to be anonymous. It's not really an issue at your organization. Like anonymity is not really an issue at your organization because everybody feels so kind of part of a family.
Yeah, 100%. So as you can call it anonymous, you can shoot an email in if you want, but I can only think of maybe one or two times in the past year where someone didn't leave their name and number. Like everyone that calls in really doesn't have that fear. I remember an anonymous call, but they didn't really mean to make an anonymous. They called back and wanted to know why they didn't call them. So There's a, I don't think there's any fear here. I think the fact that, you know, we have courage as a value and that, you know, everybody knows there's no retaliation here, that there's no fear. And it starts with the open door policy. I mean, sometimes we get calls and I was like, hey, did you talk to the supervisor? No. Are you afraid to talk to him? No, he's just on vacation. So I don't think people even have a fear of bringing stuff up, whether it's to the next level in the chain or go ahead and call the compliance line.
Would you echo those feelings, Bethany?
Yeah, I would definitely say we have a culture where we promote courage and we promote trust. And I think also we've just had the philosophical approach of trying to make the compliance hotline a widely publicized, encouraged communication tool. So
yeah.
We are heavily regulated and we have a lot of compliance to maintain. So why not encourage people to help us do that by telling us where we have a problem, where there may have been an issue.
Let's talk a little bit about what drove you to take it in house, and were you guys both there when that happened? And if you were or weren't, what were those straws that broke that camel's back for you guys to say, you know what, we just need to do this ourselves? Where was your vendor falling short?
I don't think our vendor really added value because they didn't understand the business quite as much as I do. So when someone calls in and they talk to me or Bethany or Anna, you call in and you say, hey, you know, I don't think our staffing nursing ratios are right. You know, we got our hours cut and they feel uncomfortable about it, you know, maybe because their pay got cut by an hour. I'm way ahead of the game because I know what our staffing model is. I know what it's supposed to be. I understand all those rules. And outside vendors, sometimes they're just really taking in the call and logging it for you. And they're not asking the right questions if they don't really know. So really, they become more of an answering service if they're not really, they don't really understand your specific industry. And so there was also another reason that I didn't really like her vendor, but that's the main reason I would think anybody would want to bring it in-house if their vendor's not meeting their needs because they don't understand their business well enough.
Gotcha. What do you have to add to that, Bethany?
Not much. I think I would agree that it seems to me like, you know, we view maintaining compliance and all the work that comes with it as our responsibility. So, you know, we outsource the line. It seemed to me, although I wasn't part of the decision at that time, it did seem to me like we were just paying for an answering service, since ultimately we were going to need to do the work of addressing the complaint or figuring out how to solve the problem.
Gotcha. Let's talk about, you know, that quote you gave me from Charlotte that was feedback is a gift, and how that has played into this whole decision to bring it in-house, and how you've been able to preserve that ethos in driving this speak up culture that you guys are kind of the purveyors of, or the guardians of.
Yeah. So recently we actually affiliated with Mirth and Spread Again, and the company that became part of Human Good also had a vendor. And so we actually made the decision twice now to eliminate the vendor and bring it inside. We only received a few compliance calls total. And we actually receive a lot. But like Bethany says, we publicize it. Her predecessor, Louise, designed a great poster. Like, it's like a friendly poster. And, you know, we plaster it in all 111 communities. It's posted a lot. I don't know. We probably have 500 of those posters up. It's good. So we want people to call. And Charlotte, our former VP, you know, she always said, feedback is a gift. So if you welcome the feedback and you tell the team members you welcome the feedback, and you don't, of course, because we're in senior care, we have to have compliance. But if people feel that we want the compliance line, that we're promoting it, we're saying, no, call us in, give us that gift, tell us, you know, if you think something's out of whack, I think we can get a lot more response than just, you know, having it in your handbook, having a poster up somewhere to make it legal. So I think the overall culture, that comes from everyday conversations. We have a huddle every day, we call it Connect, in every community, where every team member gets to talk about a topic. 5 to 15 minutes. So our team members are used to talking. They're used to talking to the supervisor. And I think that helps to, you know, let this snowballs into they're okay with talking to anybody. They talk freely to our CEO.
That's a big point. I think engaging folks, giving them a voice like on a daily basis, to your point, where they feel like they're a part of this thing. I mean, Bethany, you were saying on your first day, they're like, you're going to love working here. You, Troy, have talked about your culture as like a family. You guys do these sort of daily. So those are nice ethos things. Those are nice sort of soft things. But this daily practice of having a daily huddle, giving people a voice on day-to-day items, day-to-day challenges, whatever, really does sort of foundationally reinforce the speak up culture that you guys have so successfully been able to create in your organization. What would you say your reporting rate is, or how many calls do you guys kind of get on an annual basis, if you don't mind sharing that?
I actually have them, but I don't have them right in front of me. Hold on one second. Give me a minute. Can we come back to that question? I can look it up.
Yeah, sure. Why don't we talk a little bit about the pain points that you guys had to, that you had to live through as you transitioned from a vendor to bringing it in-house. What was that like? How did the way that you handle cases change, if at all? How did the way that you message about the line change to show this new sort of commitment to the speak up culture? Let's speak into that a little bit, please.
Right. So when we made the change and eliminated the vendor, I think it was pretty seamless to the most people. You know, we have the 800 number changed and the email changed. But we really didn't over-publicize like who they were calling before, that they were calling an outside person. So it was just more that, you know, we want to hear what you have to say was the whole message. And so it was pretty seamless. It really didn't have a challenge coming from the vendor to us managing it. The only downside, unless you're, you know, we're not 5,000, we're not 5,000, so we don't have a 24-hour operator answering the phone. So you do have the, you know, the pain point. Some vendors do have, you know, 24-hour call centers. Or the Absinthe vendor, for example, has a 24-hour call center. You know, it's pretty phenomenal to be able to pick up the phone because senior care, we're 24/7.
Right.
So we did lose that capability. So we get a lot more voicemails from that, you know, evening and afternoon and evening shift. So we have lost that capability, but the person that registers those in and logs them in, the log that Bethany's looking up right now, she's really quick. You know, we call the person back the next morning at 7:30 or 8 o'clock usually. So it's not a big gap, but obviously people can get frustrated if they call and get a voicemail. Hey, we want to hear from you. Here's the voicemail. So I would say that's one of the challenges. If you're doing it yourself, if you don't have 24 service, you know, people could feel maybe a little mixed message there.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But I think, you know, based on how we talked about it, the care that you meet them with when you follow back up with them, hopefully can sort of bridge that any sour taste or whatever. Let's talk about the investigation process, because I know you guys run your investigations and, you know, let's say something's left on the voicemail, you're having some kind of a conversation to get to the root of the problem. How are you tracking that investigation now that you don't have a vendor?
We track it internally. Someone in the legal department tracks them really good. Nothing's closed out until it's closed out. Anybody that actually makes a complaint here, I have an investigation closeout form. So then I can get a copy, not of the entire investigation, but you make a complaint about anything. You know, I don't think we're doing something right. You're going to get, you know, the allegations were substantiated or they're not. You're going to get a copy of it. And they'll get to check whether they agree or disagree. And if they disagree, they can write why they disagree. But I think just knowing that I'm going to close it out with them and they get to have a say and that it was closed out, one, it keeps it from escalating. I mean, part of the reason for a compliance is to keep things from escalating outside of your agency, right? You know, you don't want someone going to an attorney and wasting money for no reason when something you can handle. So I think closing that out is probably one of our best practices. The fact that I ask everybody to sign in or acknowledge they received it, that I closed out the investigation with them, it makes them feel like, oh, they really did it. It wasn't just me calling in. Because otherwise you just call in and you don't know what happens. And a lot of places that I've worked, to be honest.
Yeah, a lot of these guys have just cases that are open forever and they never get closed out. And the person who overcame whatever fear they had to make that complaint or to raise their hand and speak up, they never get that loop closed for them. And you guys seem to do that. Do you manage this stuff primarily on spreadsheets or web, or do you have some kind of a system that's either built into your ERP system, or how does that logistically work? How do you sort of logistically handle getting this closed out and substantiating it and so forth?
It's ultimately managed in a spreadsheet, but so the sort of overall tally, which I can give you, in 2019, we had roughly 130 calls total. So that's including residents and team members across, let's say, 95 affordable housing communities and about 21, depending how you count, senior living communities.
So that's around a 3% rate. That's a pretty good reporting rate, I think.
You could probably double that easily, that number, because if they just call me directly and complain, and they, it's not true compliant, they just say, hey, Troy, things aren't right here because or whatever, I'll be honest. I track inmates when I close the loop, but they didn't go through the compliance line, so I don't log them into compliance. So our number is probably about double that when it comes through me or the regional HR directors.
Gotcha. So we talked a lot about, before we started recording, we were talking about how a lot of organizations will look at sort of compliance as this outside entity or as this sort of stepchild of the broader organization or this sort of check the box function. It doesn't seem like that's your company's ethos at all. It doesn't seem like that is how your company views the roles that you folks play. Can you talk a little bit about that? Where does that start, A, and what light bulbs have gone on at the top or at the board level or at the CEO level in your mind that have allowed your ethics and compliance or HR roles to be so integral to the achievement of your organization's purpose?
Well, I said before, I view one of the primary functions of compliance and the hotline is communication, right? So allowing leadership, giving leadership an opportunity to hear from the ground up what's going on. But then I would say the other sort of function of compliance is influencing behavior, right? So it's more top down, from my perspective, understanding the regulations and then giving team members the tools to structure their jobs and perform in a way that maintains compliance. I think to me, both of those aspects of compliance are really sort of hallowed functions because they support our team members and then they support our residents. The whole point is, keeping everyone safer, keeping everyone respected. And I've certainly found at the leadership level that resonates. So, I remember a time and it was because of a call that came to me through the compliance hotline. There was a concern that the way we were staffing certain types of care wasn't quite right in that state's regulatory framework. And so I took a look at it and I spoke directly to our COO and I said, look, in this state, I think we do have a problem. Although in this state, the regulatory climate is just in a place where we're probably not gonna get in trouble for it. And the COO just immediately said, look, if we know that what we're doing is not legal, we change it. It doesn't matter. And I just really loved hearing that. I was, recently stepped into the role of GC, and it was just so comforting and empowering to know that that's our leadership's position.
Yeah, it makes your life a little bit easier because you don't have to worry about dancing on a line or trying to achieve whatever, dollar efficiency comes from getting as close to that line without stepping over it as you can. You can really just focus on, well, what's the right thing to do? And we'll just do the right thing.
Right. And I will say we did correct that issue.
I'm sure you did. Okay.
I think that really is just because of our CEO and the values and our mission, but it also helps being a nonprofit because we actually make everything like that. So I mentioned before, skilled nursing is rated by outside agencies on a 1-5 scale. And we're 5-star everywhere. We can really get down to 4-point-something average throughout the year, but, you know, we're 5-star. So we always try to scan and work towards that. So people here know, like, you don't have to make a penny or take a risk or understaff or, you know, do anything that would put anything at risk for us not being premium. And I think that really helps. You know, if you had a company where you were trying to make a profit in senior care and you weren't shooting for that 5-star, those big, large skilled nursings that are 3-stars and 180 beds, you know, I can see them having a lot more problems with compliance. But for us, you know, we're not afraid to spend the money to make things perfect for our residents or our patients.
And for some of our listeners who aren't familiar with senior care or aren't familiar with this star rating, can you just talk a little bit about like how impressive this is? This is not like a Yelp rating. This is a very big deal. And I just don't want that to get lost on folks because, you know, again, we think ethics and compliance and HR are strategic levers for organizations. And if it's done right, if it can affect the culture and it can drive the culture, to Bethany's point, it can drive behaviors. And to Troy's point, it can really be that foundation of trust that allows that strategic, you know, direction of the organization to be more readily achieved.
Yeah, so I'll give a hint for anybody that ever has a family member that needs to go into rehab or skilled care, look up the star rating. So the star rating isn't done by individuals, it's not done by patients, it's not done by people. So it's done by state agencies. So in California, the Department of Social Services comes in and inspects us. They do annual inspections, they do on-the-spot inspections. Big team auditors come in, charge into the building, and tear us apart, look through everything from policies to break to resident care, go through the medical records. They really dig in to see what we're doing, how we're billing. And then they give us a rating based on a pretty complicated system, but it ends up simplifying down to 1 to 5-star. So, you know, I don't know how many skilled nursing in the Bay Area, but I know at one point, you know, there were only 3 that were 5-star out of probably, you know, the 70 that are here. And we were 2 of the 3 that were 5-star.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. So for anybody that's looking for skilled nursing, you can always look for their star rating. That's an outside agency with people saying, hey, this is the place that you should go.
And the ultimate agency responsible for administering the rating system is CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So it's a federal program, but the states, as Troy said, the states are the ones that come in and inspect and report.
So as we wrap up, I'd love to hear just some kind of an actionable tip for our listeners who are they're likely not in an organization like yours that values the ethics and compliance and HR role to the extent that yours does. What kind of tips can you provide? What's one actionable tip or one takeaway that somebody listening to this can maybe start to put into practice today to start elevating their role to this strategic lever that your organization clearly sees you as being?
I would say, you know, one of our activities, and I was thinking about it, our week-long connect, we talk about the same topic for 5 days. One of them actually is feedback. I usually roll that one out around the fall prior to the annual performance reviews. But that's just one of the ways, and that would be the key thing for me, is to promote that not only are you not going to get in trouble, we appreciate you calling in. So here's an 800 number, here's the compliance email. They call us directly, like I said, a lot of the times, and go straight to your managers. We have an open door policy. Everybody does, but here it really is that. So I think if you're just promoting that feedback on a daily basis, you know, you won't have that, oh my God, we have this compliance issue and we're violating the law and we're going to be in trouble, because you'll know about it before it ever got to that level, you know, because people will come forward if you have that culture. And if you don't have that culture, the new one I was at before, where you got the 3 compliance calls for the year, in a hospital setting with a lot of people. So, you know, that's not good. That means people are willing to do whatever to make it happen and cover it up. So you want that feedback. You don't want people not calling.
And kind of goes back to what you were saying about those daily huddles that you guys have. This is kind of reinforcing that same principle on a more corporate basis. And, you know, sometimes when you haven't met somebody before or you haven't talked to somebody in a long time, it's really hard to get that conversation going, right? You got to warm up and kind of reacclimate toward each other. But if it's somebody that you talk to all the time and that conversation is going, then it becomes more natural to say that next sentence or say that, you know, to have that next exchange. So I think that's great feedback, right? Or that's a great tip to not only like understand that feedback is actually a gift, but do things, whether it's on your own little team or if you can push that out across the larger organization, to really open up those pathways and those avenues of communication to get that conversation going. What else would you add to the mix, Bethany?
I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, it comes down to what your organization's about. We're very, I'd say, sort of mission-driven. Our purpose is to enrich people's lives, particularly senior citizens. And, you know, would it make sense to be a company that didn't treat people well if that's our mission? You know, you might have a completely different mission, but at the end of the day, once you've figured out what you're trying to do, as Troy said, you have to be willing to take feedback and to honestly assess, you know, how you're doing. And having a workforce and that feels heard is only going to help you achieve your goals.
And why is that so hard for people to get? Because like feedback is a gift, is something that, you know, we live by. You all live by. Why is that such a hard thing, you think, for other people? Like, why is that statement so revolutionary or so insightful, right? I mean, it's obviously non-typical, but what's at the root of that, you think?
It's against human nature. When somebody tells you something's wrong, human nature is to be defensive about it. Especially, the more pride you have in your work, and then, you know, the more hard-driven of a manager or director you are, when people tell you something's wrong, human nature is to be defensive and not accept the feedback. While the person's talking, you're already developing the argument in your mind on why they're wrong, when they're saying that things aren't right here. That's just human nature. So you really have to get away from human nature and accept it and say, you know what? Sometimes it's trivial. Yeah, and sometimes they're really wrong. They call in about something and they're totally off the mark. But just accept it. And then I think the best practice we have is to just make sure you close it out with the person so they know their feedback. We actually had a little, I would say, a compliance spiral, and I don't think we counted it as one call. I think we counted it as one call, not the dozen that we got from one business unit. And it was because one person called in and they had that positive experience and they didn't like their manager. We had a bad manager, it happened. And so they just kept, so they had everybody in that unit, call compliance. And so they didn't use compliance what it was for. But the good part about that, and while we went through the situation, was that they promoted calling in, and that it wasn't a negative experience. They didn't get fired over it. They didn't get canceled over it. It's safe to call in. And so while that situation was bad, it spiraled a little bit. The fact that they all felt it was okay to call in made me feel good that me and Bethany are doing something right, because people feel it's okay to call compliance.
I would agree with that. You know, of course, it's hard to hear negative feedback about what you're doing, especially when everyone's working so hard. But I think it's also, you know, it's competitive running a business, whether it's a nonprofit or a for-profit, and solving problems, you know, listening to feedback takes resources. So I think it's also kind of a strategic decision you have to make. Are we going to allocate resources towards hearing this feedback, responding to it, just generally, you know, viewing the landscape as what we do as sort of subject to the need to maintain compliance and, you know, being willing to do something about it. Because it's hard. I mean, every other day I get an email, I think, oh gosh, how are we going to fix that? And you have to bring in all these different departments and, so it's a real challenge, and solving problems isn't always easy. But if you're not willing to hear the feedback, you're never going to get there.
Yeah, and I think inherent to, you know, the point that that you're both making, both from what you just said, Bethany, and from the point Troy made about it being sort of against human nature, is, you know, the kind of insane belief that, well, I have no room to improve, which obviously if you ask anybody if they're perfect, they'll all say, well, of course I'm not perfect. Well, the other side of that coin is that there must be room to improve. And yet we resist that feedback, both on an individual and sometimes at a corporate level. So how can people find you? how can people connect with you? Are you on social anywhere? Is there a way that people who may have questions could reach out to you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn. There's a lot of followers on LinkedIn. Corey Keach, K-E-A-C-H on LinkedIn. And you know, if it's another company calling to ask about how to do investigations and close them out and make people feel comfortable with the HRs, they can email me directly at troy.keach@community.org.
That's awesome. And then just your home addresses as well would be great. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But you know what? Like, we can change the world if we help each other and we open up to each other and figure out ways to work together so that we're not all trying to like reinvent the wheels in our own little shops, you know. Sharing these best practices, that's really what this platform is for, to give folks who are in our roles a voice for us to share techniques and to really try to elevate positions that other folks are in, like yours, in organizations that don't value them or that pigeonhole them. How can we break them out of that glass ceiling? So I just appreciate you guys coming on today. I appreciate your candor. I appreciate your transparency with the challenges that you face and the insights into how that decision has really been reinforced by your culture and how you've used that decision to bring it in-house to really continue to drive your culture and to drive the speak up, you know, environment at your organization. Because really without that, it'll never turn into a work family. It'll always be this corporate thing, this sort of sterile thing. So just again, appreciate you both, appreciate your time, and look forward to continuing to get to know you and stay connected.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.